Hello, and welcome to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. We are the boyfriends. I'm Billy Ray.
And I'm Joel.
And in today's episode, we're going to be doing Season 4, Episode 15 of Desperate Housewives, Farewell Letter. And in this episode, I'm going to be doing the outline and leading the episode, and Joel's going to give us his fun facts and trivia. So do you have anything to start us off with?
Always. So this episode aired on the 20th of February 2011, and it was written by Marco Panette and directed by David Grossman. So there was promotional pictures released depicting a scene in which Keith apparently tries to take a picture or film a video of his son Charlie holding a baseball. That scene obviously never made it into the final cut, but I have seen the picture and it's quite weird. I don't quite get what the point of the scene is.
Okay.
This episode marks the end of a string of guest appearances by Brian Austin Green in every one of the first 15 episodes of the season.
So his run is officially over.
Yeah, this is the longest streak, starting with the first episode of the season for guest stars that was previously held to Brent and Shane Kinsman, who played Preston and Porter in the first half of the season before the time jump, and Gail Harrod, who played Jackson Braddock in season 5. And they both had 8 continuous guest appearances.
Cool. So he won.
In the end. He had the longest amount of time. And this is the last episode in which Keith Watson and Zach Young are seen.
That's weird.
Yeah. EW.com recapper Christian Blolvelt was very positive towards the episode, only criticising Susan's storyline, and he's quoted as saying, "Farewell Letter turned out to be a surprisingly funny, poignant episode. Maybe it's because each of our characters, Susan excluded as always, took time to become their own shrinks and deal with their ongoing issues. The unexamined life isn't worth living, right? Well, the TV character who leads an unexamined life rarely makes for great TV. In fact, Farewell Letter was such a step in the right direction, it may have gone halfway to putting this rocky season back on track."
I wouldn't call this season rocky, personally.
I wouldn't call this season rocky either. I've really enjoyed rewatching this season so far.
Susan is the standout in the way that everyone is getting some sort of analysis, I suppose, but hers is kind of the funny B-roll of the episode, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'd rather be Susan right now than Brie. At least Susan's got an interesting story.
Nitz wasn't that serious.
No.
She only had a little introspective moment.
Yeah. So this week, 10 Downing Street receives a new cat to boost the battle against mice seen on television scuttling past British Prime Minister David Cameron.
Okay.
Monarch butterfly colonies in Mexico more than double in size after bad storms reduced their numbers the previous year.
I have a question. Does the Prime Minister own the cat, or is it now part of 10 Downing Street?
It's part of 10 Downing Street.
Okay. Maybe the cat could run the country.
Do a better bloody job. Motley Crue singer Vince Neil begins a 15-day jail sentence for drunk driving in Vegas.
Is that it?
Yeah, 15 days. Argentina lodges an official complaint against the United States after America's landing of a military plane loaded with undeclared sensitive material, including guns, drugs, and satellite phones, leading to Argentinian government expressing concerns that the US was attempting to sneak its cargo into the country.
That's dodgy.
Mm-hmm. A Palestinian teen is released from Israeli custody after the police officer who allegedly beat a confession out of him fails to show up to an inquiry. The teenager was held in Israel for 7 months for allegedly throwing rocks.
at people?
I don't know, it doesn't say, it just says throwing rocks.
Okay.
US pop singer Bruno Mars pleads guilty to cocaine possession in Las Vegas.
Oh dear.
It's always Vegas. Yeah. Researchers from London's Natural History Museum claim that ancient skulls found in Goh's Cave in the Cheddar Gorge in the southwest English country of Somerset show signs of cannibalism.
Oh god.
Which is pretty fierce. The Hawaii Senate approves Hawaii Senate Bill 232, legalising civil unions for gay and lesbian couples, and will be sent to the Governor Neil Abercrombie for approval.
That's a good start.
Yeah. Aretha Franklin announces a return to the stage. The inquiry into the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is released, finding that the accident was entirely preventable.
Of course.
Anthony Graves, an American man found innocent of the murders which left him on death row for 18 years, is denied restitution due to a technicality.
Right.
And finally, British gay Muslims fight for equality and the right to be Islamically married.
Cool.
Yeah. So, US number one song this week was Born This Way by Lady Gaga.
Hell yeah.
And the UK number one song was Someone Like You by Adele. That was a powerful duo
that's
week. Yeah. And the number one film in the US was Unknown, which it's unknown to me.
Damn, we'll never know what the number one film was that week.
Apparently there's a film out there called Unknown. I've never heard of it before in my life.
Me neither.
And unfortunately, the number one film in the UK was Paul.
Oh, right. I really liked that when it came out.
I hate that film, but I don't like the actors in it.
I like the actors.
And that is all the trivia I have so far.
Okay, then. So, looking forward to some more later on, hopefully. Let's start with a previously. So, Paul was told that his mother-in-law is Felicia Tillman, which Beth is unaware of. Beth unaware that Paul knows, not unaware who her mum is.
I have a mum.
Gabby opened up about her traumatic childhood abuse to her therapist. Bree eventually told Keith about his son Charlie. And Mike and Paul teamed up to help Zach.
Yes.
Let's start with Bree's story, because it's Joel's least favourite, and I'm sure that he'll like that we're getting it over with.
Yeah.
So Bree watches from a window as Keith plays catch with Charlie. It's an adorable moment, and you can tell that the guy really is a great dad, and like, he's been wanting this for ages.
Yeah, he is really good with Charlie. We can clearly see that.
Mm. Amber then comes to pick up Charlie as they have to pack for their flight home. And back inside, it gets a little tense as Bree says that she wishes they had more time together. And Keith rightfully points out that they would have had more time together if she actually told him that he had a son and not kept it to herself.
Snap.
I hope he also has this attitude with Amber.
Yes.
Bree kept it from him. Not great, but Amber did that for a lot longer.
Amber, yeah, kept it from him for 6 years. But I guess it's harder with Bree because you expect Bree to be honest with you.
There's a different level of trust, right?
Yeah, Bree is who you are with. Bree is your partner and you would expect her to be 100% honest.
When he asks why she did what she did, she says that she didn't want to lose him, but he tells her not to make it sound romantic because what she did was selfish. But they do end up hugging when Keith says that they will get past it. And I think the reason that that happened was because the breakup wouldn't be quite as impactful if they hadn't at least temporarily made up a little bit.
No, but I do think it's very big of Keith to admit that he thinks that they can get past it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if that's something that I could do. I don't know. That isn't something I could do. Like, full stop. Full stop right there. I couldn't do it. That would break up their relationship right there and then.
So Keith is back from the airport and Amber and Charlie are gone. Although he's only known Charlie for 3 days, he doesn't know how he's going to live without him. And then he recounts to Bree what it was like growing up with a dad that wasn't around and how much it hurt him. He seems pretty defeated and he heads back inside.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of two completely different situations, really.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, Keith's dad was in the army,
mm-hmm.
so he was off for work, essentially. But that isn't really what's happening with Keith and Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
So it's two completely different situations.
But it probably feels the same.
Probably.
Not having a dad around. So Bree and Keith are in bed and he says that he knows how she can make it up to him and says that they should move to Florida. He says about how her kids are all grown up and she sold her business and what's holding her here. And she says that she can't move because this is her home, despite him trying to convince her. He then says it's the only way to be closer to Charlie, but wouldn't want to move without her, as long-distance relationships don't work. Bree tries to talk about it, but Keith turns off the light to go to sleep.
Like, no, I'm not dropping my life and losing my home for you. Like, I'm sorry. Like, such a narrow view of things. Keith's attitude really annoyed me in this scene. Just simply for the fact that he was just like, what's keeping you here? Your kids are grown, you've got no job.
Mm.
Like, wow, way to make me feel depressed.
I mean, I don't blame him for asking her to move.
No, I don't blame him for that at all, because he is probably does feel like he's stuck between a rock and a hard place. However, the wording, I don't think, landed very well.
Yeah. So Bree walks into the lounge to find Keith playing catch with himself and thinking about Charlie. Bree says that he shouldn't need to distract himself from thinking about his own son, so tells him he should move to Florida to be with Charlie. Bree says that there's one relationship here that isn't going to work, and it shouldn't be the one with his son. But Keith says he loves her, so he can't leave. Although, the way he says it was interesting. He's like, well, what about this? I love you.
Yeah, it was kind of lame.
Yeah, it was a bit like, oh, you thought that was going to eat, but nope.
It didn't eat.
It didn't eat. It's starving. Bree then says that with the age difference, she already lived more life than him, and she's had her kids, and even though she's fallen in and out of love, she's always loved her kids. And that is something that he should experience too. Keith starts to cry, and she says that he might think he'll never love again, but he will. And then they hold hands as he says that he doesn't see how that's possible right now.
But I question Bree in this scene.
Sadly, that is how that scene ends.
It does, yeah, it ends. That's it with them, really.
Mm.
That's it. That's the last time we've seen Keith.
Why do you question Bree in this scene?
Because she lies to Keith and says that she's always loved her kids. And that is bullshit.
I don't know. I think she has, but she certainly hasn't always liked her kids.
No, she completely kicked Andrew out. of her house. She had an absolute issue with her son being gay. That's not love.
Was it just being gay, though? Or was it also all of the awful things?
I mean,
things?
Her son is also an arsehole, but her son was acting out because he was gay. And then Brie made it worse by not showing him unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you're not giving your children unconditional love, I don't believe for a second that you genuinely love your children.
Yeah. Either way, though, she's not wrong. You can fall in and out of love, but love for your kids is something that you should have. And he should be able to experience that, so...
Yeah.
Sadly, that means that this relationship does have to end.
It does. It that's it now.
Which means that we do have to say farewell to Keith and his arms.
I know, and it's really sad, because I actually really liked Brie and Keith together.
I did as well.
I thought they... I mean, I know not a lot of people did, but I thought they balanced each other out very well, and Brian Austin Green is hot.
I thought it was a nice relationship, and it wasn't just one of those one of them's older than the other 5-minute relationship things.
Mm.
It lasted a surprising amount of time.
Yeah.
And it did have some meaty scenes and story, and that's good.
Yeah.
So it does feel like a shame to have to say goodbye to Keith, and he was so refreshing to have after... Orson.
He really was. And now let's see who Brie gets with next.
Yeah, so let's move on to Lynette's story, which straight away, I have to say, it's really weird that they're not continuing the story with Stella.
Yes.
Stella has only just become rich. We've just seen her start to turn to the dark side even more than she already was.
She's blackmailing her daughter in order to keep her essentially in the will and to get the money, and that just kind of ends.
Yeah, it does not continue in this episode, so I can only hope that we see some more of that in the future.
Mm.
But let's talk about what happens in this episode for Lynette. Mary Alice opens the episode talking about how much sleep Lynette has missed over the years because of her kids getting sick, midnight feedings, and late night pillow fights, but generally kids misbehaving.
Yeah.
But apparently she's never complained, which I find extremely hard to believe.
Oh, absolute bull! I'm sorry, what is this?
Lynette is a complainer.
Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty sure she has.
Yeah.
We then see Twin One wake her up in the night to ask where the eggs are and how to make an omelette, and this is unacceptable.
I mean, it's been a long time since I've made an omelette.
She goes downstairs to find the twins have brought home some random girls from the club to feed. First, the boys inform Lynette of the difference between a booty call and a hookup, which was a fun moment. And then the boys tell her that they're old enough to do what they want before Lynette goes back to bed.
This bitch... And then she's like, can you make mine an egg white scramble? Whatever the hell that means. And I'm just like, bitch, she's not a short order cook.
Right. I think what we're supposed to really glean from this scene, though, is they don't know where the eggs are.
No.
They don't know how to make an omelette.
Like, in your own home, it's quite shocking. But if you're going into somebody else's home, people leave their eggs in all different sorts of places. Mm-hmm. So you do never really know. Some people refrigerate them. Some people don't refrigerate them. So, you know, it is difficult. But this is your own home, kid. You should know.
Following the horrendous incident of the previous night, Lynette and Tom tell the twins that they have 7 days to find a new place to live. There is some arguing about how they like living with Mum and Dad, until Twin 2 asks how they're going to afford their own place, and Tom sarcastically tells them to get a job. But, like, you need money for rent and deposits before you can get a place to live, so maybe they should have more than a week.
Yeah, they should have more than a week. Like, I was quite shocked that they don't have a job. Like, I know they're in college, or at least one of them is in college, because one of them does say the agreement was that I could stay here until I finished college.
Mm-hmm.
So at least one of them is in college, but not even like a part-time job. Like, did they just get their money from Mum and Dad?
Well, I guess so. It's not that common for people to have jobs when they're in college and stuff.
I think it is. Quite common for people to have part-time jobs.
None of my friends did. I was the only one.
Yeah, that's because you have bougie rich friends.
I did have bougie rich friends. So the boys have packed their car and they're about to move into their own place, promising Lynette and Tom can visit in a couple of days when they're settled in. They then drive off as Lynette gives Tom a sort of sad hug until they pull up just across the road and make their way into Karen McCluskey's house as she shouts to Roy that the new tenants have arrived.
At first, I was sitting there thinking, oh, they've found a place quickly. Like, are there no tenancy checks and shit in the US? But obviously they've gone to McCluskey's, so that'll probably be why they didn't really need to go for a whole tenancy check. But, like, credit to them. I say credit to them in this instance. They thought smart, okay? They were pushed out the nest and they weren't like, no, we need to think smart right now. Just go tree adjacent. We'll just jump to this tree instead.
Yeah, it's a little bit safety net.
Yeah, it really, like, it's really is.
It's a soft push.
And considering that Karen McCluskey hated the twins in the first half of the show, and she really liked like the sensitive ginger one. And
Parker.
She's, yeah, that's the one. Thank you. And then she's letting the twins move in with her. Quite an arc.
Yeah, quite a drastic change.
Quite a character arc for the twins and Miss McCluskey right here.
Mm. So Lynette and Tom are staring from a window. It's weird that Susan doesn't do that in this episode, but everyone else seems to.
Yeah.
At the McCluskey household, and Tom is annoyed, as this isn't what they had in mind when they spoke of leaving the nest. But Lynette says that Karen's a tough lady, so if anyone can whip them into shape, it's her.
Mm.
She then answers the phone to Karen, who asks Lynette how to make the eggs the way that she makes them, because apparently the boys like hers better. So she decides to go over there.
A Denver omelette, whatever that is.
The fucking audacity. Yeah. Also, Karen, where's your edge?
Yeah, right. What? This is so disrespectful. Like, I expect a better from Karen and Roy.
She had edge, but now she's basically a circle.
Yeah.
She finds everyone at the dinner table, including a couple of girls that the boys brought round, and the boys complaining about Karen's cooking.
The same girls that he brought round at the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
Like, it's the same girls. And she looked like the same one that was like, can you make mine an egg white scramble?
Yeah.
Turned to Preston's mum in this scene. Preston's mum. Turns to Lynette in this scene and goes, hi, Preston's mom. It's Mrs. Scarver, you bitch.
I love, like, that Lynette just goes, like, she doesn't like her.
Mrs. Scarver to you.
So Lynette is horrified that the boys are in another motherly relationship and they're not growing up, this time with Karen. So she has an aside with Karen about it, but Karen is absolutely fine with the boys and says that they're good tenants. She then mentions that the girls that they brought home light a fire in Roy. And as long as she's the one that gets to put that out, that she's fine?
Yeah.
The problem is, they have no manners.
Zero manners.
Where are the manners? I don't see any manners.
No, and this is a comment on Lynette and Tom. Lynette, Thomas, what have you been doing? These boys have zero manners.
And why aren't you calling out the lack of manners? It's happening right in front of you.
Right in front of you. This is probably why they've got no manners. And Karen, like, come on, girl. Where is your balls?
So Lynette is at Karen's, talking to the twins at the front door, and tells them that she has a gift for them, as they really have grown up. To their surprise, the gift is it's a keg.
Yeah.
They wonder how they're going to be able to drink it all by themselves, when Lynette suggests having a party, which the boys are well up for.
Are these boys stupid? Are they dumb?
Well, because they can't see that their mum clearly is concocting some devious plan.
Yeah, they grew up with Lynette. Surely they know now when she's plotting something.
Yeah, because Lynette has plotted
quite a lot
in this show.
Yeah.
And it's never subtle that she's about to do something terrible.
No, it's never subtle. She really shows it in her face. I like to think Lynette thinks that she's really subtle with it. Like, she's planning a devious plan. But it's so obvious that she's twiddling her mustache. Like, bitch, you need to wax that upper lip, girl.
Yeah. Karen comes home to find that her house has been completely ruined, and so Karen drags them out to Lynette's by the ears. Although, where was Karen when the party was happening?
I don't know.
The boys seem very unapologetic, leaving Karen to storm off. They then ask for breakfast. They're obsessed with the eggs this episode.
They really are.
And Lynette tells them that once they're done cleaning up Karen's house, they're going to look for another place to live. They say that they've just been evicted and that they're hungover, so it's not really a good time for them. Leading to Lynette calling them hopeless. And then we get the moment. So, they then blame Lynette for this, as she apparently wouldn't let them do anything, as she always thought it'd be easier to just do it herself, which Lynette then realises after a moment's contemplation is actually true. She says that she probably wanted them to stay kids forever because when she was growing up, she had a crazy family, crazy sisters, crazy mum, crazy life. She was working, doing the dishes. She never had the chance to actually be a child herself. So she wanted the boys to have a proper childhood, but let it go too far. She then tells them that she's sorry, but it's time for them to go and start living their own lives. And they say okay, but first they want an omelette, which she says no to, but that she'll teach them how to make one.
I gotta go my own way.
I thought this was quite a nice ending.
They really did manage to get out of it, didn't they? Like, even with a mum doing everything for you, you can still learn how to do stuff throughout. But they, in this whole thing, they were like, oh, well, we couldn't ever learn how to do anything because you always did it. But you can still learn when people are doing stuff in front of you. I mean, I say that, but if Bea were to die right now, I wouldn't be able to cook anything.
There are relationships, though, where you're not allowed to do stuff because you can start doing it and they'll just take it off you.
Yeah, control.
Like this. And so when they said that, I did think, actually, I can see that with Lynette. I can see how that might have happened.
Do the kids not realise what adult life is like, though? They're like, oh, we've got to find another place to live. We've only just been evicted. Yeah, guys, that's kind of how it works.
And we're hungover.
Yeah.
Like, you have to do a lot of stuff when you're hungover. You're going to have to get used to that.
And like most adults, if they get evicted, do need to find another place to live.
These boys are ill-prepared for life, but sometimes growing up and actually becoming independent means just, you know, moving out and doing things yourself.
Yeah.
I did it when I moved to university.
Yeah.
And I won't underestimate them, because maybe when they find a place that isn't just across the road, they can actually become more independent.
I think they could really thrive.
Now let's move on to Susan's story. Susan is on the phone with her insurance company because apparently they only cover partial payments of her dialysis.
Mm.
She then spills coffee on herself when trying to avoid a chipmunk and serves her right.
Yeah, and the person talking to Susan on the phone must be gagged because she's listening to all of this.
And she gets pulled over by a police officer who tells her that he pulled her over because she didn't stop at a stop sign. She bangs on about her dialysis to the officer because she can't keep anything to herself.
No, she can't.
And the police officer lets her off with a warning, making Susan realise that she might actually be able to get away with a lot of stuff if she brings up her condition.
Yeah, at the beginning of this episode, Susan has learned a valuable lesson. It's normally the end of the episodes where we learn the valuable lessons, but this time Susan learned it at the beginning, and that lesson is that illness can be used to your advantage if you manage to get the right person.
So Susan and MJ are at the supermarket, and MJ is being such a little brat because he has to wait in line when Tom and Jerry is starting soon. She tries to calm him down, but he says that she promised and gives the cute puppy dog eyes, so she asks him to go grab something from one of the shelves so that he doesn't see what she's about to do. When he's gone, she asks the people in the queue if she can cut ahead of them, as she has dialysis and she gets weak when she's late. So the people kindly let her in front of them.
I swear, like, I'm sorry, but MJ's being a brat because Susan made a promise that she shouldn't have made.
That is,
like,
true.
You don't promise shit like this. You can't control how busy the store is. So why promise your kids something you know you can't guarantee? It's so fucking stupid.
MJ then comes back and gets excited to see that they're at the front of the queue now and shouts, "All right, we're going to see Tom and Jerry."
Fucking kids ratting you out. Like,
so Susan has to pretend that Tom and Jerry are a nurse and a doctor who go at each other when they're mad.
Which is... bitch, why lie? Why not just tell them?
We can't see Tom and Jerry. I have dialysis. You can watch it at the hospital.
Yeah, well, that's what I would have said. I would have just said that my son gets to watch Tom and Jerry whilst I'm in dialysis while he waits for his dad to come pick him up.
Ugh, boom. Yeah.
So now he's excited because we're going to get to dialysis on time and he gets to watch Tom and Jerry.
So Susan is with Renee having coffee whilst on the phone to the jury duty people to let them know that she'll be late or something because of her dialysis. But then they just tell her not to worry about it and they let her off of her doing jury duty.
Yeah.
Which I think is better, actually.
This Susan's the Willow Rosenberg of this show. Is this the season where we get Dark Susan? She realises her true power and potential.
Yeah. After hanging up, she gleefully talks to Renee about this, and Renee is quite proud of Susan for using her disease to manipulate people, in her words.
Mm.
So Susan says that using her disease for evil is the only good thing that's come out of this whole thing, and Renee convinces her to use this to get them into a fancy restaurant, which she agrees to do.
This restaurant's a marketing genius.
What do you mean?
Well, the reason that Renee needs Susan for this is because this restaurant, whatever it's called, Savano's or something like that, doesn't take bookings. They only accept walk-ins, which it's marketing genius. Like, you don't allow people to book, so there's mystery around your restaurant, which then drives up the interest, and people will be willing to wait just to try it because they know there's no other option. You can't book, so you have to wait if you want to try it.
True.
It won't last forever. People will get sick of that eventually.
That'll last long, though.
No, but the way to get the initial interest, it's brilliant.
So Susan and Renee are at the fancy restaurant, but as expected, it is full. The receptionist tells them it'll be about an hour wait, so Susan asks if they can squeeze them in because she has dialysis in an hour.
And the woman goes, "I'm sorry, we're slammed." And Susan says, "Just like my kidney."
Yep. She says that she'll see what she can do. This gets a pretty negative response from all of the other clients who are waiting, and we have a clip.
"Sir, she's lost both of her kidneys. A booth would be great."
"Well, I'm a diabetic. And my wife has rheumatoid arthritis. You don't see us trying to get any special treatment?"
"You don't understand. I'm on dialysis. Arthritis, diabetes, dialysis. So unless somebody here has Ebola, I think we should get the next table."
You think there isn't anybody in this place who doesn't have something? We all have something.
I have restless leg syndrome.
Shut up.
Do you remember Ebola? Do you remember that was the big thing?
Yeah, that was the coronavirus of the day.
It was. Ebola was huge. It was everywhere. It was big. Huge.
This guy is everything that I wish to be.
I'm sorry, the disrespect to those of us with restless leg syndrome.
Shut up.
Like, I have it. I don't use it to get into places, but I still have it.
But I don't blame him. They're talking about serious stuff, and then this lady just comes up with that. I'm like, shut up. Go like, to the back.
My restless leg syndrome annoys the hell out of B. But yeah, I'm with this dude. Shut Susan down now. She's gone drunk with power.
Yes, I completely agree. So the guy then rightfully says that the only thing special about Susan is that she thinks that she's more special than everyone. So they try to haggle with the receptionist one more time, saying that Renee used to date a quarterback.
She used to be married to a Yankee.
That was it. But they get sent to the back of the line.
Yeah.
Susan then genuinely starts to feel sick, and not just because Renee tells her that she has to pay for the meal.
Yeah.
Even though Renee thinks that she's faking, and then Susan passes out.
And even Renee's like, Susan, get up for God's sake.
Yeah.
Like, no one's even looking anymore. You're so starved for attention.
Yeah. It's always fun when Renee and Susan get together.
Yeah, I really enjoy them together. I think they're a good pair.
So, that was Susan's story.
It was, yeah.
Why did she faint? So serious all of a sudden.
Yeah, I know.
Gosh.
I wonder if they're going to get fed now.
Okay, let's move on to Gabby's story. Gabby is complaining to Carlos about how crappy her hometown is whilst they're packing to go there. She says that they're small-minded, bigoted, and have bad teeth.
Which is basically the UK.
Yeah, welcome, welcome.
Welcome. And she also said that the town is famous for having the second longest tire fire in America.
Outside of Springfield?
I was literally about to say, probably closely followed by Springfield. And she makes this town sound so basic.
Carlos is trying to be positive, but Gabby is not having it. So he says that he knows the real reason she doesn't want to go back there, and it's because of her past.
Yeah.
Which is not very... It's not really much to Carlos, like, duh.
Yeah, I know. It's like, stating the obvious much, but growing up in a small town, I did always dream of making it huge and then returning to the town to see everyone who was awful in their rightful place while I celebrate, like, the star that I am and have everyone else celebrate the star that I am. So I get why Gabby would not want to return here.
Yeah, yeah. We then find out the reason that they're going is so that Gabby can read a letter that she wrote to the man who abused her at his grave, which her therapist told her to do as a way to move on to get some closure. They then agree that she'll read the letter and then they can come straight back home.
This therapist already sounds better than the therapist that she went to see with Juanita.
Yeah, yeah. So after a difficult taxi ride, Gabby and Carlos are in town, but they seem a little lost. And then a woman comes over to ask if they need help. She recognizes Gabby from the magazines and excitedly welcomes her back to town when Gabby sees a nun across the street. She seems to have a pretty sad reaction to seeing this nun, and so she quickly gets into another taxi, or the same taxi.
It's literally the same taxi. And I don't know why that taxi driver was waiting there for them when they weren't planning on getting back in.
Yeah, I thought that was weird. That's why I was like, is it another taxi?
No, it's the same one.
As they do, we see the nun make eye contact with Gabby and give her a disapproving head shake. Like, bitch, what's your problem?
Right, what is your problem? Maybe she's just, who knows, maybe she knows Gabby. Maybe she's a big fan of Gabby, but she doesn't like to admit that she's a fan of Gabby because she's a nun.
Yeah, either way, that's an interesting way to introduce a character.
It is, yeah.
So Gabby and Carlos make it to a cafe, and she sees what it's like to be a celebrity arriving back in their hometown as she's got all of her magazine covers framed on the wall. She quickly gets surrounded by people wanting a picture, as well as the school principal, who tells her how proud everyone in town is of Gabby. He asks if she can visit the school to give an inspirational speech to the girls, and that they can let the press know about it, which Gabby agrees to, despite Carlos telling her that they actually have a flight to catch in the morning.
Oh please, flights can be cancelled. I'm sorry, my secretary has no concept of community.
And asks who else wants a picture with her, and she takes a moment to just enjoy being in the limelight, which is very Gabby.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, if you could have any food or drink named after you, what would it be?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
We'll have a think about it.
Okay,
What would it be?
I'll let you know later. What about you?
Let me know later.
Well, I'm on the spot.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, but that's the point. Just think what the first thing that comes to your head.
I don't...
Let me know later isn't going to help the listeners right now. How is that interesting for them?
I don't... Well, like, can it count if it's already a branded item?
I mean, if it's a type of food, then yes.
Because the first thing that came to mind was a Terry's chocolate orange. But I don't know if that can count.
No, you'd be a mac and cheese.
A mac and cheese? Yeah. So why did you ask?
Huh?
Why did you ask?
Because I've just thought of a mac and cheese on the spot for you. Maybe that's like, how it works. You do it on the spot.
Maybe a Cajun mac and cheese or a spicy mac and cheese.
Fine, yeah, it can be anything. It's just a mac and cheese. They'd name you a mac and cheese after you. You know
what? I'll be a loaded fries.
Okay, you'd be a loaded fries.
What about you?
I don't know, food or drink. I would probably be...
Actually, no, I'll be a wine.
You can't just switch up three times. First you're a mac and cheese, then you're a loaded fries, now you're wine.
I switched up once. You loaded the mac and cheese onto me.
Yeah, and then you started considering mac and cheese. And then you were like, actually, no. Anyway. Actually, first, you were a Terry's chocolate orange bitch, so don't start saying you switched it up once.
Yeah, but you pressured me into that.
I did not pressure you into that. I asked you a question and asked for an answer. I didn't ask you to sit there and go, well, yeah, let me think about it for, you know, 6 weeks, and then I'll give you a detailed 75-page essay on why I would be X amount or X food.
So what would you be? On the spot.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, but you don't see me sitting here going, I'll tell you tonight. I don't know, I'd be something fabulous and skinny.
You can be a radish side dish, there you go.
A radish? No, I think I'd be like skinny fries with something on the side.
You can be a savoury muffin that doesn't have chocolate but has beets.
No, I'd be like a chips and gravy. I fucking love chips and gravy. I'd be like a chips and gravy plate, but it'd be skinny fries and not chips.
That's a bit fucking common, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it's good, but no, it's not common for me. My bloodline is common.
Yeah, but like, if something was going to be named after you, you're like a big star at this point.
Yeah, but you know, nachos are common.
Mm-hmm.
And Gabby's a big star. Yeah. Named after her. It could be anything. I think I would be skinny fries and gravy.
Okay.
Yeah. Almost like poutine, just without the cheese.
Curds. I don't know what poutine is.
Poutine is chips, gravy, and cheese curds.
Oh.
It's French.
That sounds awful.
It's the French, like, I don't think it's the French national dish, but it's like the French delicacy.
No, that's bread. So Gabby and Carlos are in the hotel room, and she's just finishing up a phone call with the local paper who are writing a story on her. As she tells them, the place that she feels most at home is probably New York, which Carlos feels a little bit shocked by. He tries to remind her of why they're here and says that they have some work to do, but Gabby says that she doesn't really need to do that anymore. He then asks how she plans to get closure, but she says that she already talks about how healing it is to come back to the town and how much everyone loves her. He says he worries that it isn't enough, and she tells him not to worry and talks about how happy she is.
Carlos is so dense. Closure. This is closure for Gabby. Going back to the town where she was abused and the abuser is dead and Gabby is, well, Gabby. Like that. That's what's better closure than that? That would be my closure.
Baby, you've just shown how dense you are. It's a distraction. It's not closure.
That would be my closure. That would be my closure. I'd be like, yeah, do you know what? The person that abused me is dead and here I am living life, like having a great time. I am a celebrity right now. He wishes.
Okay. So Gabby and Carlos are at the girls' school, with Gabby giving advice to a group of girls, telling them that they should drop maths and science as they cause frown lines.
Who wants frown lines?
He asks her to say that she's joking, but she insists that young girls need to know the dangers of long division.
I'm with Gabby again. Once again, I'm with Gabby. Long division is dangerous.
So the principal then dismisses them so that Gabby can talk to Sister Marta, the nun from earlier.
The nun from the nun.
She asks Gabby what brings her back, and then slags her off for always being the centre of attention. Before doing a walk-off, Carlos is... I think he notices that there's definitely an air of awkwardness tension? In the room.
There is tension. I mean,
she basically slagged off Gabby right in front of him.
Right, and a bit of a judgy nun, ain't you, bitch?
You always loved being the centre of attention.
I do love this nun, though. She comes up and she goes, so, Gabby, what brings you back?
Yeah, she's just awful.
She's brilliant.
Gabby then tells Carlos that she'll be right back, and goes after her. Yeah. And Carlos does just stay behind, and it's probably for the best. I think he knows that.
I think Carlos kind of realizes that Gabby needed to take this moment herself, and he can just go back and continue talking to the young girls about how Gabby was incorrect and long division isn't dangerous.
Yeah, she's just joking. She's such a joker. She's a prankster.
Lol. Like,
be funny like Gabby. So Gabby follows Sister Marta into the church room. The chapel room?
The chapel, I guess.
To talk, and brings up a conversation from her childhood in which she told her what happened with her stepfather, but apparently Sister Marta just thinks that Gabby had an overactive imagination from trashy magazines and such or something.
Yeah.
And that she made it up.
All those trashy books and magazines you used to bring into class. Trashy books?
I don't know. Maybe
Harry Potter?
Twilight?
Yeah.
Gabby is shocked that she still doesn't believe her and reminds her of what she told her when she was a child. She tells her that she made her feel ashamed of herself ever since and that she came here to get some closure. And we have a clip.
I came back here because my therapist had a crazy idea. She thought it would help if I stood on the grave of the man who abused me and told him how I felt. But you know what? I think I need to tell you. I did not deserve what happened to me. I was a child. But you were a grown-up and you did nothing. You should be ashamed of yourself.
So that was quite a serious clip, which we don't play often.
We don't.
Although,
know.
If you know anything about me, you know that when it comes to TV, I love a good telling off.
He does. That's why his favourite of the Queens and the Crown was Olivia Colman.
But this was a good telling off, but it had so much emotion behind it.
It did. And I actually really appreciated the fact that it almost made Gabby revert talking to this nun again. And you hear it in the language she uses, where she uses the word grown up, because that's a very childlike way of describing an adult.
Yeah, because we would say you're an adult.
You were an adult and you did nothing. But in this instance, when Gabby's telling her off, she's almost reverting back to her childhood ways of the nun being the senior and Gabby being the junior and saying you were a grown up.
That's good. That's a good spot. That's probably some quite purposeful character work, actually.
Yeah.
With that line. Carlos then asks if she's okay, and Gabby says that she's ready to go home now. So yeah. That's the end of Gabby's story. I think she didn't come what she came here to do, but I think she did get the closure that she was looking for, in a way.
I agree.
So we're now going to move on to the last part of the episode, which is Paul's story.
Paul.
So Mike and Paul are taking Zach to rehab, and it isn't a pleasant car ride. Zach is begging to go back and promising to go to rehab tomorrow. And when the guys don't back down, he starts being a bit spiteful and blaming Paul for his situation.
Yeah.
Paul then loses it and pushes him against the back of the car, shouting at him that he's going to rehab or prison for shooting him. This seems to calm Zach down a bit. Paul also puts Zach's seatbelt back on, which I think was a sort of sweet parental moment, just to remind us that as fucked up as this relationship is, he does actually still love Zach.
Yeah, like Daddy Paul, someone does angry very well. But Paul really looks down on Zach in this scene. Like the disgust in his face when he's looking at Zach and Zach's like, rehab, like, just let me get out of the car. Like the disgust on his face. Like, I saw that look. There's no judgment here, Paul. We don't judge people. He only got high and shot you.
It's probably very upsetting considering that what happened with Mary Alice to see his son like this all these years on, you know?
Yeah.
Paul gets home to Beth cooking dinner and asking him how it went with Zach. She seems happy that it went well, but starts to talk about how he's been pulling away since the riot, but now they can get back to normal and starts building their life together. She goes to pull him in when she feels the gun on him, which he says he's keeping hold of for protection after his son tried to kill him. He then starts to question her about why she brought a gun into the home when Beth gets upset and asks why he's so upset with her. But unfortunately, she just gets a vague response like, I've just got a lot on my mind.
I feel really bad for Beth in this scene.
He then tells her of how she's betrayed him and he does a walk-off.
Beth is literally losing her mind with how distant Paul is. She like grabs the gun and she throws it in the bin and she's like, we don't need it. Like, just tell me what the hell is going on. Like, you're not talking to me. And Paul just literally stands there and watches her break down.
This is the problem. If you're annoyed with someone, tell them why.
Just tell them you're annoyed. Don't just stand there and watch them slowly fall apart while they try and figure out why you're annoyed.
Yeah, he's like, you betrayed me, and then he walks off, and she's just like, what the fuck are you talking about? Paul is seeing Zach in rehab and asks why he shot him, to which he simply responds, I wanted you to die. straight to the point.
Yeah, I want you to die. Why else would I shoot you?
Paul isn't happy with the answer, so Zach elaborates and says that he's hated him his whole life. And then he grew up and felt nothing but hatred, and that's because of how Paul was basically so evil. And, I guess the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
No,
just had this conversation between Paul and Beth, like, a few episodes ago.
Yeah. And this is a very interesting scene, because Zach ends up saying to Paul, like, it's your fault that things have turned out the way they are, and it's your fault that Mum killed herself.
Untrue.
And Paul immediately goes, don't say that, it's not true. And it's made very clear to us as an audience that Paul believes that he is the reason that Mariella shot herself. However, we all know as an audience that Paul didn't want to go ahead with Mary Alice's plan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Paul was the one that was happy with not buying the baby off of, what's her name? It's been so long, I've forgotten it. Angela? Mary Alice was the one that wanted to buy the baby. And Paul really didn't want to because he knew that that would be hassle. The biological mother then turns up clean, sober, ready to get the baby back. And Mary Alice is the one that murdered Zach's mum. So Zach can sit there and act like episode one of Desperate Housewives doesn't explain who Paul is. But that day is essentially the beginning of who Paul is.
Oh, yeah. Like, I know he wants to put that little bit of venom in there.
Hmm.
And maybe there is some question in Paul's mind as to, have I always been evil? Have I always been like this? Is this the reason why Mary Alice did this? Or is it a bigger reason why?
Hmm.
But we can't forget everything that led up to the whole Dana incident and the whole Martha Huber blackmail of it all.
Yeah. So I just, I mean, I couldn't imagine what Paul is thinking because I've never been in this situation before. But for me, it just kind of didn't really land very well that Paul reacted so harshly to what Zach said.
Maybe there. If he said, your mom killed herself because of blackmail.
Hmm.
And then he said something like, you always were spiteful and evil. She was going to do it one way or another. I don't know.
Yeah, like, I think that this could have worked as a scene if they had a bit of rewrite.
So Beth comes out of the shower to find a suitcase on the bed and asks if he's leaving. He says, no, you are. He starts to drag her out and she asks why. And he tells her that he knows who she is and that at least Felicia hated him to his face. He drags her out of the house and she tries to tell him that he's changed her and that she loves him. But what Zach said has clearly got to him and he says that no one could ever love him and slams the door in her face.
Giving his very best pheromone.
You don't love me.
You don't love me.
So, and in the ending scene as well where Mary Alice narrates her usual trap, we do see that she pretty much is just walking the street and she has nowhere to go.
I know, and like throwing her out with wet hair, like that's just heartless.
Yeah, you can dry your hair and get out.
Like, girl could catch hypothermia like this. Do you have no heart, Paul?
I mean, I do feel really bad for Beth here, but I also don't blame Paul and I completely see where he's coming from as well.
Oh, I'd be hesitant as well, but I do feel really bad for Beth because she was just manipulated into this situation and then... Yeah. Now she's not being believed. It's very sad.
Because now, I mean, as Paul, how can you ever believe anything she says?
Yeah.
After all that.
There's always going to be that doubt. Always that doubt.
But damn, poor Beth. She needs to move away and start again somewhere else.
She really does.
So that was the end. So let's move on to our next segment where Joel is going to give the gayest moment of the episode. So what do you have for the gayest moment?
My award for gayest moment goes to Gabby for jumping into the car and running as soon as she saw a nun.
Yeah. No explanation needed there.
Yeah, right now. I don't blame her, to be fair. I'd do exactly the same. I'd be like, ew, a nun, and then just jump.
Oh, nuns can be such lovely people,
they
though.
Can.
But
they
this
can
is not be. One of them. And what do you have for straightest moment?
At my award for straightest moment I'm giving it to Keith and Charlie.
Keith and Charlie?
Yeah.
Is it for the catch?
Keith and Charlie? Yeah, for playing, like, with the baseball. Like, way to break the gender roles, Keith.
Yeah.
Just because he's a boy doesn't mean that he has to, you have to teach him to play baseball, you know?
But then he's like, oh, you threw the ball so hard. Oh, my hand.
Oh, my God, my hand. Oh, so straight. It never happened to me.
Or me.
So now we move on to B's awards for best and worst parent. So who do you have for the best parent?
My award for...
best parent of the episode
goes to Susan for getting to the front of the line so that MJ doesn't miss Tom and Jerry.
Oh boy, we can watch Tom and Jerry.
And he wasn't wrong. He probably did get home and watch Tom and Jerry.
And so who do you have for the worst parent?
My award for...
worst parent of the episode
goes to Lynette for convincing... not even really convincing either. She got her twin boys to throw a big party for her own nefarious purposes.
Yeah, I know. And then breaking loads of Mrs. McCluskey's stuff. Do you think I want to go back to Wyoming?
Yeah, her collection of state-themed shot glasses.
Yeah, I know. Why?
She had nearly one from every state.
She was this close to having one from every state.
Yeah. So, Bravo, bravo, fucking bravo to everyone for their awards this episode. That was Season 7, Episode 15, Farewell Letter. Where can people find us if they have any questions, queries, comments, and theories?
You can find us on Instagram at BoyfriendsReview.
Our email address is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com, and all of the podcast artwork is done by our friend Louis, who you can find on Instagram at DocRedMonkDesign, and there is also a link to his Etsy page. Join us next time when we'll be back in your earholes with Season 7, Episode 16, Searching.
Yes, see you then, guys.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye.